Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IEA London YouTube channel, but we've taken the audio and turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Hello, I'm Steve Davies, the Head of Education here at the IEA. And today we're going to be having a book club short where the IEA turns to sit down with prominent free marketeers, classical liberal authors and notable writers from around the world to discuss their books. And today I'm joined by academic and author Dr. George Meyer to discuss his latest book. George holds a PhD in the economy of the Roman Empire from King's College London. He's a fellow of the Institute and Faculty, I should say, of Actuaries, and was a director and trustee of the Society for the Promotion of Roman Studies. He was a partner at Tillinghast Powers Perrin, and he continues to practice consultancy in the area of actuarial science. And most recently, he's authored a fascinating book based upon the research he did for his PhD, entitled Pugnare, Economic Success and Failure. So, George, thank you so much for being with us to talk about your book. Well, let me start with the point I ended off with there in my initial remarks. It's a long time since the Roman Empire ceased to be, by most conventional accounts. And you may say, as Monty Python did, what have the Romans ever done for us? So what indeed was the Roman achievement, at least in the first part of their history, and what does it have to tell us today?
I think the major thing that the Romans did for us was they showed us lots of ways in which you can get things right. And we can learn from that. Lots of ways in which you can organise yourselves to work together. Mm. In. And they also showed us what a complete mess you can make of things if you get them wrong. They had a superb trading empire which replaced their military conquest model. Built it up to an extent that's quite unbelievable, really. Productivity at the time of the Roman Empire was three times what it was in medieval Europe. That's like more food, three times as much food coming from the same plot of land as a thousand years later. Their ships were bigger than you would see in the Mediterranean basin until probably the 18th century. They invented a superb world currency, which collapsed in the middle of the 3rd century because of their mismanagement. And the world would never again see something similar to that until the 18th century in England. So great achievements, and we learned from what they could do, and we also learned from the fact that they messed it up.
Messed it up, indeed. So, to summarise what you're saying here and what the book says, from the time of Augustus until really the early 3rd century, the Romans create, as you say, a trading empire. They create a large integrated economy, which covers an enormous area, all the lands around the Mediterranean and big northward extensions like Britannia and Gaul and inland Iberia. And within that area, there's a complete division of labour, essentially, so that you have integrated trade, you have a highly productive economy, and if you go to somewhere like Pompeii or Herculaneum and look at the digs there, you can see that people there were living at a standard of living that would be higher than anything achieved for a very long time after that, probably again, as you say, until the 18th century. So it's an amazing achievement, and this is done partly as Pax Romana, but there's also Roman law, so there's a common law throughout the empire and things of that sort. So you mentioned, though, crucially, the monetary system. So how important was the monetary system for this great achievement, the creation of this great trading economy?
Absolutely. Vital. The division of labour that you mentioned there was almost extreme. If you look at memorials that are established by set up by people to commemorate their father or whoever, that they often write on it his profession. And they're very, very specialized. You'll see some man described as a maker of eyes for statues. You need to have an awful lot of eyes to go into statues to make a living out of that. So that it's highly specialized, but also indicative of a vast amount of stuff being produced, which means a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunities. And the currency is vital to this. They had the largest cities that would exist on the planet until the very end of the 18th century, possibly the beginning of the 19th century. And you cannot have a city such as Rome with 1 million inhabitants without a money system. People need to have those coins that they get from their customers and that they use with the suppliers who supply them with wine or food in the little takeaways or whatever. You need to have a gold coin, a silver coin, and a copper coin. You need to know that the relationship, you know, is you get one a gold coin for 25 silver coins, and you need to know that that's not going to be disputed in the shops. You need to be able to, you know, get on a boat, go across to Alexandria and know that, you know, it's acceptable there. You're not going to be haggling about, well, actually, today I feel like just giving you 10 silver coins for that gold coin and all the rest. So vital. And what they did, and this isn't very much appreciated, is they built a superb banking system. So Seneca, the teacher of Nero, transferred about 200 million in our money to London, you know, not out of charity, but to lend out to the locals at interest. And indeed, when he called this money in, because he needed it back at Rome, very suddenly he triggered. It was one of the reasons why the revolt by Boadicea was triggered. And, you know, he didn't do that by, you know, sending coins in, you know, tons of coins in a ship. He did it through an international banking system supported by a uniform law, the same in Rome as in London. And, you know, that trade, that specialization is not possible to that extent unless you have a currency that is trusted over a wide area.
Yeah. So you have a stable currency, which doesn't inflate, and that currency also has a stable unit of account, so the ratio between the two different types of money remains constant and stable and predictable over time. And it's that quality, in other words, of predictability you're arguing, which makes possible people planning forward in the future and engaging into things like long-term contracts, like insurance contracts, your own line of business, and the banking system. So what kind of things had the Romans from Augustus onwards had to do to create this really quite previously unprecedented phenomenon of a large geographical, stable, predictable currency system? What did they have to do that made it possible?
There was a Greek fellow called Polybius, and he asked himself a similar question, and it was about 200 years before Augustus, you know. Why are they more successful than us, the Greeks? You know, because the Romans had come in and, you know, conquered the Greeks. The Greeks lost. And his answer was in their constitution. So how they organized themselves. And it's kind of interesting that the way they organized themselves was kind of like how companies nowadays organize themselves. You've got shareholders who vote on this and that, you've got a board of directors, and you've got an executive, a chief executive. But the other thing that was important about them was they were adaptable. As and when things needed to change, they changed. So one of the things they had was they had a tribune of the people. I mean, he represented the plebeians. And that fundamental change to their constitution, the introduction of a man with power of veto over the other magistrates, came about when the plebeians weren't happy with the way things were being run, and they went on strike. They withdrew from Rome, and the change happened. What happened for them around the time of Augustus was their old constitution wasn't working. This whole system of having annual elections and all the rest wasn't working. Prominent individuals were tearing at each other, and they changed. And so instead of having these annual elections, they, in my view, collectively allowed a new position, a head of state for life, to emerge, but not. Not an unaccountable head of state. There is still the Senate. It's not eliminated. It is still fundamental to the lawmaking process. And indeed, it has the power to condemn the head of state to death. You know, something for him to think about. So I think it came about because of their constitution, the way they organized themselves, and by the fact that they were willing to adapt and change as necessary. Mm.
And so essentially what you're saying is they had an effective decision-making procedure and process,
yes.
But they were, and they were therefore able and willing to make tough decisions when the occasion required it, but also to change when it was clear that the old Republican constitution, for example, was with the two consuls, was no longer working, and they needed to create the princeps, the principi, to run things. So they've created this stable monetary system. One of the things I know you mentioned is the way that they'd also centralised the production of money, the physical production of money. In Rome, so that there wasn't mints dotted all over the place that anybody could get hold of.
Sure.
So I suppose the question to ask is, well, as George Best famously got asked in a hotel room, where did it all go wrong?
That is a great question. And in my book, Pugnare, I lay out the events that are happening. I lay out the stories of, you know, Commodus, of Marcus Aurelius, you know, of Commodus mocking the Senate, for example, and also the mismanagement of the state finances, and you can look at all of that, and I've written this book, so you can form your own answer on all of that. But I think it was complacency. Mm. I think it was complacency. I think it was, you know, they had stability for well over 100 years. You know, the ports are functioning beautifully. You know, there's a mass of goods to buy in the markets and all the rest, you know, and it's, you know, as it's been, you know, in living memory and memory of their parents and grandparents. And I think maybe they just forgot what was really important to all of this. And they no longer paid attention. And they no longer notice that, you know, this is going a bit awry and it's not trivial. This actually matters. Mm-hmm. So my view is complacency. And, you know, could happen to us now.
And I suppose to further to what you say there, what they lost sight of was the centrality of having a stable financial and monetary system for the whole system that they were benefiting from. They, as you say, took it for granted, really, and they forgot that that was what it all rested upon, essentially.
And underneath that, there are things such as a Senate, which is receiving news, which is listening to what's happening, and which is saying, you know, maybe this shouldn't happen. Maybe the world is changing. We need to change, you know, because the world never stays the same.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and indeed, I mean, I would sort of point to one thing, which is that one of the things that does change is the sudden appearance on the Roman Empire's eastern flank of a rival empire of equal power, the Neo-Persian Empire of the Sasanians.
Sure.
And this means that the Romans suddenly face something they haven't faced since the Punic Wars, really, which is a military threat that is massive. And their response is to enormously increase military spending. Now, that's a crucial part in your story. So why is it exactly?
I think I might take a slightly different view on that in terms of the newness of the threat. It's always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it still is. You know, I mean, you read the newspapers and you hear about difficulties coming from Iran.
Mm.
And the threat that the Romans had through their history was often from there. So sometimes we think it's a new enemy, but it can actually, or a new problem, and it can actually be an old problem that people are no longer quite so good at dealing with.
Right.
And I think that's a fundamental to it. And it can also be that, you know, the wrong solution is now being applied to it. I mean, paying soldiers, you know, a large amount of extra money and putting a massive burden on the state's finances for doing the same amount of work and maybe making some of them think there might be more to come isn't good for discipline.
right.
and isn't good for success against well-trained, disciplined mm-hmm. soldiers. So, you know, Augustus had a very disciplined approach.
Yeah.
By the time you come to Marcus Aurelius, maybe it's not so disciplined.
Yeah. So, I mean, the famous episode is, of course, that when Commodus, whom you mentioned, after he's overthrown, there's another emperor for a brief while, and then the Praetorian Guards actually sell off the imperial title to the highest bidder. And this provokes a political crisis, which eventually ends up with Septimius Severus becoming the emperor. Now, what exactly happens at this time? How is it that at that point the monetary system you described really stops working?
At this stage, I mean, Septimius Severus basically, buys the support of the army by doubling their pay. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take the largest item of your budget and you double it, you're going to have a problem. So if the authorities in the UK were to say that tomorrow they'll double the amount of paid to the NHS, I mean, mm-hmm. it's going to be a shock to the system, and it might not recover from that. What happens? The money has to come from somewhere. Mm. It's a silver-based system, so you start to devalue. And there have always been devaluation. It's gone like this, and now it goes like this.
Right.
And once they started, it was like an addiction. Mm. You know, it just had to keep going. And when it goes like that, it goes down to zero. Mm. I mean, the coins that are then produced, I mean, hardly have any silver in it. It's just washed over the surface to try and fool people into thinking they're silver. It's gone, really, then.
Yeah. So in the 3rd century, then, which is what we're talking about here, basically, sure. The empire, they make this fatal decision to try and fund a large increase in their major spending items sure. through debasing the currency. Sure. And so they destroy that stable monetary system sure. that had been built up after Augustus, which had played such a crucial part in creating this amazing economy and infrastructure sure. they'd built. So what was the result of their doing this?
Well, once the coinage is no longer respected, the banks are gone. So they're gone. They disappear from the record. No more mention of them for a good few hundred years. So that messes up trade. Mm-hmm. And before this chaos, ships travelled across the Mediterranean. You know, they didn't need to carry coins. You know, documentary proof and effectively bank transfers by letter. And from 250 onwards, it's the first time you really start to find coins on shipwrecks in mm-hmm. the Mediterranean and industrial quantities of them. So trade is severely hampered. That means high unemployment because fewer customers. Urban life becomes very difficult. You know, if you haven't got a currency, how can you live in a city? People start to leave the city, it becomes depopulated. Mm-hmm. The cities do with no regular payments for the soldiers. They are effectively mercenaries. There's a lot of disorder. Mm. So for hundreds of years, and especially through the trading empire miracle, there had been no need to build a wall around Rome. Mm. Just absolutely no need. Mm. 250, massive wall is built, which still survives.
Yeah, the wall of Aurelian, indeed, yes.
Exactly, which was needed in Italy until, I think, the early part of the 19th century. So the peace that had existed until 250 AD did not exist in Italy until into the 19th century.
Yeah, until the Risorgimento, in fact, really, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there was something really, really lost.
Yes. And so all this comes essentially from debauching the currency, because it deranges the whole economic system, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you want to have a specialized trade, as a maker of eyes for statues or as an actuary, or indeed as a historian, you need to have a currency, so that you can get money from someone and be able to give it on to someone else who gives you what you really need, which is food, drink, and a place to live.
And so in the absence of a reliable currency, you have a quite different kind of economy, much more localised, much less productive, and much more subject to rent extraction, I would add, also by predatory landlords. Yes. So you said that we can learn from the Romans about how to get things right, and we just talked about what they meant got wrong, like a major policy error, really, in the 3rd century, from which arguably they never recovered. So are we in danger? Could we do the same thing now?
Absolutely.
I mean, yes, do you think so? So how might we do it?
If you want to know how to do it. I think we, given that we're no different to them in intelligence, given that you know, human nature hasn't changed, yes, we could do it. Again, I think we could do it by being complacent. I think we could do it by not understanding what are the parts of our system that really matter. Yeah, I think one way in which you could do it, if you wanted to try, is by excessively, you know, making money out of thin air. I mean, a load of money has been created in the last year. So in the United Kingdom, $450 billion was magicked out of thin air. So for every £2,000 of money, there was about 18 months ago, there's now £2,500 of money. And that was absolutely necessary to keep an economy alive and jobs continue to exist and so forth. But if that, you know, mechanism is abused, you end up in exactly the position that the Romans were, in which excessive amounts of money are created, the currency is no longer as valued as it was, and very important things then fall apart.
Yes, indeed. And I would add to that, George. I mean, I think the United States, for example, I think is perhaps in danger at the moment of going down the route that Septimius Severus and his fellows did in the 3rd century, because they've expanded their domestic broad money supply by 35% and are poised to expand it even further. And I suppose the real risk, I don't know if you agree with this, is that you can do things like that on a kind of one-off basis to meet an emergency crisis. The real danger is you get into the habit, as you say, you get hooked, and it is like a drug that you keep on using, because once you've set off down that road, very hard to recover.
I think that's exactly right, and I think the United States have started on an experiment, and I hope it works out well for all of us. And as you said, I mean, it was the problem of you know, Septimius Severus. You give the soldiers, you know, 100% pay increase, and there's a likelihood they'll come back and ask for more next year. So this money going out, if it's being in the United States, if it's going out in a properly managed way, then it will do good. If it's done in such a way that it creates an addiction, then it will be an absolute disaster.
And I suppose the thing to conclude is, if you were a Roman growing up in, you know, Italy, or in fact any part of the Roman Empire at the end of, say, the reign of Antoninus Pius, you think you're living in this amazing world. You've got these huge aqueducts bringing water 135 miles, for example, in the case of Carthage. Incredible civil engineering, and you must think, oh, this is going to go on forever.
Exactly.
And I suppose the lesson is, it doesn't have to. You know, it can very easily suddenly unravel.
Sure, and that is one of the reasons why you know, your organization does such important work, because it's essential that in the population there are enough people who understand how these things work.
And
if there are if there aren't enough of those people, then there won't be enough people saying, this is a great thing to do, but I wouldn't try that.
Yes, indeed. And to basically to learn from history, if I might add to that.
To learn from our predecessors.
Yes, precisely. So thank you very much for that, George. I think this is a fascinating conversation. And I would sort of like encourage everyone here to buy George's book here, Pugnare. The front piece, he tells me, is the kind of conventional story about how the Roman Empire comes to its end, which is barbarian invasions, as in a really bad film starring Christopher Plummer, for example. But in fact, the real story is here in the back, which is the capture of the Emperor Valerian by the Persian Shah Shapur, and the debasement of these coins that we see dotted all over the back here, and the self-inflicted wound of the undermining of the infrastructure of the economy, which had actually been the base of Roman civilization. So thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. I couldn't have done a better plug if I tried.
Thank you. So thank you very much for you in the audience for listening to this. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation and found it fruitful. And as I say, I encourage you all to go and read George's book and learn indeed from it what the Romans have to offer us today in terms of advice and warnings. I'd also like to thank particularly the book club members who support these programs, the donors whose continued support makes the work of the IEA possible, and the IEA online patrons who also make possible this particular aspect of our work. And if you're not one of these already, I encourage you to join in each of these endeavors. So thank you all very much, and I look forward to meeting you all again online, or rather in person at physical IEA events. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the IEA podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify or Podbean. And as you've been listening to an audio recording from a YouTube video, you can visit the IEA London YouTube channel and subscribe there as well.